And I'll call the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practices to order. The first order of business, and I'm regretting that Representative Dean is not here because we have three sets of minutes to approve this morning. And he was, his name was not on a couple of these. So first we will take up the minutes from May 3rd last year. And I recommend that the minutes as amended be passed. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from May 3rd, 2017 are adopted as amended. Next, February 22nd. I move the minutes as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from February 22nd, 2018 are adopted. Now the minutes from March 12th. Representative Lunan moves the minutes from March 12th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The first bill up this morning, first some housekeeping. For this evening, we will be coming back most likely. In fact, count on it. And the plan is to come and reconvene 30 minutes after a floor session. So, and we will be meeting in this room. So with that, the first order of business is Representative Lehman's bill, and that is House File 3032. As we know, it was laid over on Tuesday in order for them to make some tightening up changes to the background check portion. And so with that, I will turn, I will renew my motion that House File 3032 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. With that, I'll turn it over to Representative Lehman.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. We're glad to be back here. We, as you know, we're here Tuesday, and we were here for the purpose of House File 3032, and the purpose of that bill is to create a set of uniform state standards that would guide transportation network companies within the state of Minnesota. There were some questions raised here in committee about the background check portion. That's what we were focusing on. So I'm really pleased this morning to offer the A5 amendment. And maybe I should just have a motion to...
Right. Representative Lehman, Representative Howell will move the A5 amendment. To your amendment.
Okay, thank you. This amendment addresses the issues that were raised in committee regarding the background check, and I'm pleased to say that the A5 amendment does now contain a comprehensive background portion that includes all felonies and domestic violence. And so that, with that, I guess we would just stand for questions on the amendment.
Any discussion on the amendments before we vote on it? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there more than one amendment, or did we have a is there other discussions about who would do the enforcement of confirming they complied with the background checks that end up in statute? Or
Representative Lehman.
Yeah. No, this is the amendment, and it just specifically refers to the offenses that would be covered in a background check. We're going to be moving on to Transportation Committee, and we'll be looking at further amendments that talk about who is the oversight agency.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, you usually deal with background checks completely in this committee, and if you're not satisfied with what it is that they end up with, are you prepared to bring the bill back?
Well, the enforcement piece, I understand from the stakeholders are talking about where the appropriate place is for the for that piece of it. And so I'm satisfied with the tightening up of the background checks. And did you still have problems with that, well, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, even if you get the background checks right, if you don't have someone enforcing it, and if there isn't a appropriate penalty, whether that's civil or criminal, it doesn't do you any good. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, at the end of the day, what is this going to look like? What does the background check look like? Who's responsible for enforcing it? And what happens if they don't comply?
Right.
And so again, if it's going to be a criminal penalty instead of a civil penalty, then the civil law wouldn't need to hear whatever that penalty is. Right. But if it's going to be a civil penalty mm-hmm. and not a criminal penalty, then it's squarely within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Right. And I would be glad to bring it back to this committee if it goes through the process and there's and that's not addressed. So if that answers your question. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I confess that I feel like this is a little weird. I didn't really even, this was, like I said in the last committee, this wasn't even on my radar until the night before. And then one group came to talk to me briefly about it, but I got the sense that they had everything worked out with the majority on the vote, so why bother a little bit? But there, I thought, were a lot of other questions, not just a background check, Representative Lehman. So is there any funding that allots for the background checks in here? I mean, is funding provided in this amendment to make sure that background checks can get done?
Representative Lesh, that's not the purview of our committee.
Well, Madam Chair.
And by the way, they will hire the people to do the background checks.
Madam Chair, the folks that came in and asked all these questions that lined up to sit down, they said there are all these gaps that are not covered, especially my city, St. Paul, came in and said, by the way, we have comprehensive background checks for taxi drivers. This is how we do it. Driver knowledge test, driving experience requirement, vehicle inspection by a mechanic, clearly defined vehicle mechanical inspections, ability to address local transportation needs. I got a laundry list of all these things. And so when Representative Lehman comes in and says, okay, we've addressed background checks. First of all, I see this amendment. I don't even really know what it does. I feel like what we're doing in this bill is a lot more serious than some, I don't know, fixes between Tuesday and today. And no one even talked to me about it. I raised questions. No one talked to me about it. So I am completely unsatisfied. And I feel like this is kind of being forced through, Madam Chair. And I'm not really sure why we can't have a longer conversation about it when this is a very important issue.
Well, again, Representative Lesh, I'll reiterate that the reason that the bill came to us was the background checks and the liability issues regarding the data that's stored. And we've talked about both of those. This bill has at least two other stops and has four more stops. So if, you know, weigh in, work with the stakeholders if you still have issues. But the reason that it's in this committee, in my opinion, has been satisfied. And so my intention today is to adopt this amendment and take a vote on the bill.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, my reservations notwithstanding, I will absolutely bring these issues up on the floor. If Lyft is not complying with the standards that Minnesota expects to make sure people are safe in cars, that people, every single member on the Florida House of Representatives, will know about it ad nauseum when it comes up, because I will bring it up, and I know other members of my caucus will bring it up. So the decision to say, well, let's make some tweaks between Tuesday and Thursday without talking to the people that brought them up, do it at your own risk. That's fine. We can bring it up on the floor, and we will at great length. So that's it, Madam Chair.
All right.
No other questions.
Thank you. Any other questions on the amendment? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually believe that I have a list of things that were included or not included. Do we have anyone that wants to say whether or not it's complete? I went through it, and I understand that a whole bunch of these issues that I brought up were addressed. I don't dispute that. I just want to know if people think that that's the right level of background check for this particular thing. We had that conversation in public safety on this particular bill yesterday, even though it wasn't before us, and people talked about, in reference to Representative Brossel's bill, whether or not this was the right standard. So I just want to know if there's anybody here that wanted to talk about it, if you would give me.
You mean as a member of the public?
Yeah.
Okay.
If they believe that this actually addresses what we talked about yesterday, just in terms of the scope of the background check.
Sure. We'll open it up for questioning. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this amendment regarding the background checks? Please come forward.
I don't know.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota. And we work with the taxi drivers currently at the airport. With regards to the background checks that are being proposed really aren't, number one, true background checks that verify that the person is, in fact, the person they claim to be. The process in which both Lyft and Uber verify somebody's identity is through the Internet. Nobody actually takes an ID and verifies face-to-face with the person to verify that that is, in fact, the person they claim to be. Secondly, the only way to really do a thorough background check is to do a fingerprint background check. The fingerprint identifies who that person is and verifies that there's not a mistaken identity. There's been case after case where both Uber and Lyft drivers have turned out to be not the person that they had claimed to be. And so if you want to do a thorough background check, the only way to do that is with a full federal FBI fingerprint background check, like what was done at the airport for many years with the cab drivers. We believe that that's the only way to verify true identity and to make sure that the person claiming to be the person is in fact that person. The reality is that their verification of identity is lacking. The fact that they never take a face-to-face identification system to make sure that that is in fact that person, to me is just absurd. Now, we're trusting these people that they're good drivers, that they're not criminals, but when nobody checks to see who they are, it's lacking. So I think to have a thorough background check, there needs to be a fingerprint connected to it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any member questions? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess this would be a question for the chairman. We talked the last couple of years about Real ID, and the Real ID process, I don't remember them thinking that it rose to the level of needing a fingerprint, that there were other verifiable or acceptable ways of determining who a person really was. I have no idea what the rigor is for the identity with these entities, but to your statement of that it would require a fingerprinting, I think there's other situations where the federal government feels that it doesn't.
Thank you for that comment. Representative Dean.
Yeah, but these drivers, I mean, when you're verifying yourself for yourself, that's one thing, but these are people that are driving, people that could be vulnerable, that are calling up an Uber. Do they do this in other parts of the country where they actually do background checks beyond just a simple little running on the Internet? I mean, I believe New York City, they actually do fingerprinting of their drivers. So aren't we, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, as important as New York?
Madam Chair.
Is that to the testifier?
Testifier or the earlier testifier who, unfortunately, I didn't get here in time to listen to. Or the author of the bill, even.
Mr. Reynoso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, you're absolutely correct. They do it in New York. They are required to have a fingerprint background check. But in the city of Austin, Texas, about a year and a half ago, they passed an ordinance requiring a fingerprint background check. Both Uber and Lyft left the city specifically because they did not want to comply with the background check. And as for transporting vulnerable people, absolutely. They transport inebriated people sometimes. And in some cases, they want to be able to transport some of our most vulnerable adults, ADA people, without background checks. And to me, that's just, it's unacceptable.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A5, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. No. The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill as amended? Seeing none. All right, roll call has been requested. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to make a statement. I'm not going to question anymore. I'm going to see this bill again in the Public Safety Committee. And so some of the issues that I want to address will be addressed in the Public Safety Committee. So I volunteered during the conversations in this committee to participate with the stakeholders in putting together what it was that this amendment should look like and what my concerns were. I specifically stopped someone in the hall and said, hey, make sure you come and see me. I heard from no one. My goal is to make sure that if we're going to do this, in this structure, the way it is right now, I don't support it. I'm going to be a no. But if you're going to do this, you better make sure you do it right. And, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no, and I strongly encourage folks that know I'm going to see it between now and public safety to at least have an open door conversation with me, because I will tell you what's wrong with your bill, whether or not I'm going to vote for it.
Thank you for those comments. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howe? Representative?
Yes.
He was dribbling his cup.
Timing was impeccable.
Sorry. Representative Lunan?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
And Representative Whalen?
The vote is 8-5 in favor. House File 3032, as amended, is on its way to the Government Operations Committee. Thank you, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Chair Scott, and committee.
She's right, though. She should be talking to her.
We're going to switch up the order, I believe, a little bit. Is Representative Pryor? Okay. I understand the Secretary of State is running a little bit late this morning, so we're going to switch up the order, and we've sent somebody to go get Representative Pryor out of a committee so she can come and present House File 3344. So we will wait for them to bring her in. In the interest of time, Representative Vogel, would you like to, well, actually, okay. Would you like to move House File, where did it go? 3344 before the committee?
Yes, I would.
Thank you. Thank you.
we're waiting for Lori Pryor. If you want to tell a joke, I'm sure we're all ears. If you want to tell a joke,
probably.
Yeah. Got a good Irish joke.
I got a whole bunch of them. I just don't want to go on the record on some of them.
Do you want a good one? Read this first line.
Who sent this out?
Who's this one? It doesn't identify who actually created the document. So.
Well, the fingerprint thing just kind of sort of balls at her feet to where they are. It's really like we have to be. It's an original document in the country of origin.
What?
You get a real idea.
Can make their life.
Oh, ho, ho. Now there's a freshman that knows what she's doing.
She wants her bill.
Yes.
I think this is an automatic passage of the bill. All right. Very good. Welcome to the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, Representative Pryor. Thanks for letting us get you out of another committee to come and present your bill. The bill has been moved, but the amendment has not.
Okay.
And so we'll have Representative Vogel move the A-18 amendment as well. Is there any discussion on the A-18? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A-18, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A-18 is adopted. The bill should be in the shape that you would like it, Representative Pryor, to your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Lori Pryor, Representative Lori Pryor, 48A. I also am on the task force that is looking at child support. And because of that, I have the bill that's before you right now, and I would actually like to have my testifiers explain it to you.
Okay, very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Kuntz. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney. As to the amendment, this amendment is intended to correct an error in 518A35 that occurred when the new parenting expense adjustment statute was passed in 2016. That statute's effective date is August 1st, 2018. In essence, this is a technical change to ensure that what was intended to happen in 2016 happens. I have additional testimony on the amendment if, Madam Chair, if you would like me to go through that, members of the committee. Otherwise, it is really just a technical change. So I will leave that to you if you have questions.
I think we're good. Why don't you go ahead to the bill, please?
The bill is striking at line 2.5 and 2.6 language that indicates that lump sum payments for child support are not subject to the Consumer Credit Protection Act. In effect, federal law says they are, so this provision of our statute is in contrast with federal law and therefore needs to be removed.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What impact does that really have if the state law says that it's not and the federal law says that it is? What impact does that have on an obligor?
Ms. Kuntz?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, what happens is the Consumer Credit Protection Act says that the only 65% of any payment or a check can be taken. If a lump sum payment is taken for purposes of child support, this would say it's limited by the Consumer Credit Protection Act and only 65% can be taken.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair, but I understand that, but what is the impact? Like, up until this point, or until this law is signed by the governor, were folks following federal law? I mean, I guess it's the counties, right? Were the counties following federal law or following state law?
Ms. Coons?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I can't speak to all counties, but I think because of the conflict in law, this makes it clear what should happen.
Okay.
Perhaps the testifier that just joined.
No, it's table. Well, it's not that important. I was just curious. It's more of a legal curiosity, and I apologize because with an agenda this busy, I probably don't have time for idle legal curiosity, but I was just wondering.
Well, we've got a testifier at the table. Let's satisfy your legal curiosity. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I am the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. That encompasses the Child Support Division at DHS. The way this was working was prior to the federal clarification for us a few months ago that the CCPA did, in fact, apply to lump sums for child support. We were able to collect up to 100% under state law. Once we had the clarification, we issued guidance to all of the counties to say that they should, you know, we would not be taking that amount, and the state law needs to change so that our state plan and our state statute matches the federal law and makes it clear for employers how much they're able to garnish. Yeah, and it is less.
Any other discussion from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one. With that, Representative Vogel renews his motion that House File 3344, as amended, be sent to the General Register. We voted on the amendment, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay.
I remember us voting on it.
Let's just do it again, just in case.
Okay. All right. All those in favor of adoption of the A18, please signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. The A18 is adopted. Now Representative Vogel renews his motion that House File 3344, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
And thank you for the treats.
Yes, thank you. Still not here? Okay.
All right. Mr. Secretary is still not here, so I will go and do my House File 3380. And where's Dennis?
Welcome, Madam Chair, to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 3380.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3380 relates to Minnesota's lien law for self-storage facilities and specifically seeks to clarify policies on online auctions and late fees. With more than 800 self-storage facilities in Minnesota, this bill represents an issue of importance to small businesses in my community and communities across the state. While most of us have seen those big orange garage doors at large public storage locations, many more of these self-storage facilities are locally and family-owned. Before I briefly review the proposal, I would like to provide some background on the history of this area of statute. Minnesota self-storage lien law was originally developed 30 years ago, and it went largely untouched until 4 years ago, at which time extensive work was done with the various stakeholders to modernize the policies in a way that meets both the needs of consumers and the needs of storage facility owners. That proposal ultimately earned unanimous support from the legislature and has been in effect for the past 4 years. My proposal today is much more limited in scope than the previous overhaul and seeks to update two items within the lien law. First, in cases where a self-storage facility is authorized to sell abandoned property in an attempt to satisfy its lien, House File 3380 would give operators the option to hold online auctions instead of hosting auctions on the storage facility. You've probably seen Storage Wars on TV, and so that's what they do on that television program. Current statute already allows for online sales, but it is less clear whether an online auction may take place in lieu of an auction at the storage facility. The second piece of this proposal seeks to establish an industry-wide cap on late fees. The establishment of late fees in state statute provides several benefits to the self-storage industry and its tenants. For the consumer, it ensures everyone receives prescribed equitable treatment. For the businesses, it provides comfort that their late fee protocol is considered an acceptable business practice. As I mentioned, Minnesota has more than 800 storage facilities, self-storage facilities located throughout the state. However, the self-storage industry itself is still somewhat fragmented, with more than 80% of the operators made up of small businesses. As a result, fees associated with abandoned units or delinquent payments are varied. Late fee standards in statute offer a benchmark of reasonable business practices and guidance that protects the consumer. Additionally, late fee standards can help avoid unnecessary litigation. In the absence of late fee laws, suits have been brought as class actions as well as wrongful sale lawsuits due to allegations of unconscionable charges. The self-storage industry encourages this legislation because it wants a benchmark in order to comply. As you can see on the map that was handed out, you got a colorful map there. 25 states have established late fees for the self-storage industry, and all except five have prescribed an up to $20 or 20% of monthly rent standard, whichever is greater. This has been considered a fair amount with respect to incentivizing on-time rent and recouping administrative costs, and is reflected in my original proposal. Finally, this language clarifies that while owners should set the late fees within the statutory safe harbor, late fee laws do not prevent owners from collecting the actual costs associated with administering the lien enforcement process. Late payment and abandoned situations inevitably cost businesses, which must dedicate resources such as staff time, notifications, and other administrative expenses in order to remedy those circumstances. All actual costs of collections and lien compliance are recoverable under the current law and would continue to be so under the late fee legislation. I believe there is an amendment, and it didn't make it to my packet.
Chair Scott, yeah. I believe there was an amendment, but it missed the deadline, and would you like to discuss
right.
it anyway?
So I don't know if my friends on the other side of the aisle are okay. What we're doing is lowering the late fee in this amendment, and so Representative, yeah.
Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Acting Chair. I don't have a problem with $20. I don't have a problem with 20%, but I have a problem when the cost of the storage fee, the rental per month, is less than what they're going to charge in the penalty. So rather than even lowering it to $15, would you consider doing it whichever is less, 20% or $20, whichever is less? And that will get you this, because I asked in my office when I met with them, what's the cheapest storage rental, and some of them were as low as $15 a month. And so if you charge a $20 a month late fee on a $15 a month storage locker, I mean, you're more than 100% of what you pay otherwise.
Right.
And so I think it's reasonable for them to get a late fee when it's proportional to what they're renting. But I would hope that you would consider doing whichever's less, not whichever's greater, no matter what dollar amount you set it at, whatever percentage.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to let my testifier speak to that matter and to your question.
My name is Amos Briggs with Lockridge Grindle now and representing the Self-Storage Association. Thank you, Representative Sistrom. To your question, you're absolutely right. The costs of units do vary around the state, and I apologize if I misspoke in our meeting. I've typically seen the low end be in the $40 to $60 range. I'm sure there are some that get even lower, but I think practically speaking, that's about where things are. Understanding that, notwithstanding that information, your concern is certainly one we want to respond to. I think the problem with whichever is less language is typically that as units get more and more expensive, that doesn't provide sort of the discouragement of late payment and the compensation that the owner would be seeking for those very expensive units, where if you were doing whichever is less at the amended language of $15 or 15% for a $300 to $400 unit where people are storing boats or cars, that might not be sufficient, to compensate the owner for the losses there. But that is definitely something we're happy to continue before the next committee staff working with you and other stakeholders on.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the sheet of paper that was distributed by the author, and the cheapest storage is listed at Lakeville at a 5.5 at $24. So the proposed late fee would be $4.80 at 20% or $20. So there's a $4 difference. So it's almost 100% of what your monthly charge is, just based on what you gave me. And then if you go with the 20%, if you rent the larger one, right, $395, your late fee at 20% would be $79. So I get that you want to be able to charge that $79 for that larger one. I just think 100% is outrageous. And I think that I don't want to discourage you from charging late fees for people who can afford it. But when you pay more in a penalty than what you pay to rent something, I think you are setting poor people up to lose their stuff. And then you're going to online auction them. And I represent a district which has high poverty. And so one of two things are going to happen. Either they're going to lose all their stuff or they're not going to be able to rent at all.
To testifier.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, absolutely. And I think our goal here is to try to strike the right balance between consumers and operators. And certainly a situation like you described is out of that balance. So we would like to continue to work to find a way to meet that concern while still making sure that owner-operators have the ability to recoup appropriate costs.
Last comment.
Representative Hillstrom.
Scott, I'll see it again in Commerce. I'm on Commerce. Okay. So we'll have the ability to work on it.
Okay, sounds great.
Representative Dean.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I'm sure this is to testifier. So many of these will have like 3 months in arrears, that's when the owner takes possession and has the opportunity to sell it. So if I'm like doing the math in my head and I'm thinking about this, so $20 a month isn't a lot to recoup on these larger units, but if I'm not mistaken, larger units tend to have more stuff. So at the time of sale, the recovery of the difference between the 20% versus the $20 would easily be, you know, recovered in that process. And at the same time, the eventually they're getting their fee or the cost of the unit. So I'm trying to reconcile why it needs to be so much more just for a larger unit in the event that that they don't end up recovering the cost of the unit and actually have to go in to sell those items.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, absolutely. A couple clarifying things and a point is well taken. First, you are right. There is a process currently in statute from the overhaul Representative Scott described a few years ago. I won't get into all of it, but there are a number of processes that take place when something goes into default, when an occupant goes into default. And sort of the very last stage there is the ability of the operator to vacate that space and try to recoup those losses through an auction. Having said that, we did have a question from another member on the committee. If there is a surplus, if they are able, as you said, a very expensive unit with perhaps more valuable items in it, if there is a surplus, they do have to return that back. They aren't able to keep the extra dollars. I would also add, just from working with the industry on this bill, more often than not, the type of property that is abandoned is in fact not valuable, and it's very rare that they're able to completely recover the loss just through that action. But certainly, again, as I said earlier, we want to strike the right balance so that it meets the needs of consumers, it meets the needs of owner operators, and puts us in a good place going forward.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to respond to Representative Dean's comments. So there's a show out there called Storage Wars, and it has what I've seen from that, and then from my own experience as a landlord myself, the larger items like mattresses, couches, are some of the most soiled, dirty, valueless objects. They're large, and they are costly to dispose of. I dread when there's a mattress or a couch left because it costs me $40-$50 just to dispose of. And then some of the smallest items, coins, paintings, comic books, really tiny items. So there's no, to equate large items with more expensive or valuable is absolutely not the case.
Just to clarify, it wasn't.
I'm sorry. Representative,
just to clarify, I wasn't equating the size of the items. I was equating the size of the unit, which generally means there's more items. So I certainly understand. I hope that people aren't spending $300 a month to store old mattresses, because that's really a bad economic situation. But so don't conflate the difference between the size of an item versus the number of items.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to hear from legal aid, or we are? Okay. Well, I'll hold off questions till then, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Scott?
If there are other folks that wish to testify, we'll...
Okay. We do have Mr. Elwood that has signed up to testify. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First off, want to just say that we don't oppose creating a bright line regarding late fees. But that said, the amount proposed, even the reduced amount here, we believe is not reasonable. We need to step back a minute and understand exactly what the late fee is for and what it is not for. It is really well settled law that the purpose of a late fee is neither to coerce payment nor to punish somebody for paying late. It is simply to recover the cost, the time value of money. And I think the discussion, I had a handout that more illustrates, I think, the points that were being made about the smaller dollar units, or the smaller rentals, and then the higher rentals, actually. And on both ends of the spectrum, they create absurd results. As you pointed out, the storage unit in Lakeville, this is online. You can look it up and see what they list as the prices. It's public. At that amount, it'll be 83% of the rental cost, and 40, 50, 30, a third of the cost. But at the higher units, then it flips the other way, and it would be, instead of $20, it would be 20%. And then you get more absurd results, because it would have charged $20 instead of 20%. The 20% comes out to be like 300% more than $20. I mean, it's just it's on either ends of the spectrum. So we think that if you look at other late fee caps in Minnesota law, we could find three. One is utility late fees, which is capped at 1.5%. Rent to own, which is capped at 5%. And apartment rental leases, which are capped at 8%. Late fees are 8%. The usury rate in Minnesota is 8%. So I think the discussion and the fact that a number of states have these high fees, frankly, doesn't make it reasonable or fair. And I think that the discussion really illustrates why this either-or is a bad structure. I think we might want to consider simply capping it at a percentage. And obviously, I think we have guidance in Minnesota law, and that's where we would land. We have a couple of other concerns about the bill I'd like to just mention briefly. On line 1.7, it allows a modification of the rental agreement. And I'm not sure if that was intended simply to accommodate the new late fee provision that would be installed, but as it stands, it seems overly broad to us, and we would suggest that the modification simply be limited to the new law that would be enacted, so it's limited to the new late fee provision. We think it's overly broad. I think of a even more serious nature on lines 2.4 and then again on lines 2.17 to 2.19. Essentially, this bill gives a blank check to recover collection costs. And if I understand it correctly, normally to do that, you'd have to take an action and have the court decide what's reasonable, what's fair, what's not unconscionable. I mean, under this provision, it would seem to me that it would allow unverified, unreasonable, and possibly unwarranted costs to be imposed on consumers without any due process. So we think that piece should be eliminated from the bill. I also note on line 2.13, it talks about periodic charges. I wanted to say that I talked to Mr. Briggs before, and he indicated that he was aware that perhaps should be changed to monthly as we had proposed, and I appreciate that. And finally, you know, as we talked about, there's a history on this bill in 2014, as you pointed out. There's a giant overhaul of this bill. Since then, at that time, we had proposed two modest amendments that would restore some, in our view, restore some balance to this lien law. It was a lazy law since 1988. Nobody said anything about it. It was governed by the Uniform Commercial Code, and all of a sudden it was completely revamped. The rationale for doing that in 2014 was that we have to modernize it because it hasn't been changed since 2014. Except there was one piece that was overlooked. Under the current law, since 1988, and it hasn't changed, even if you are in default and even if you are locked out of your unit, you are still allowed to go in and get clothing, tools of the trade, and your personal papers. Except there's a value cap on that. So only clothing that's only worth $50 and tools only worth $50. We pleaded to raise those caps as while we're modernizing everything, let's do that too. Unfortunately, our pleas were unanswered, but we think this year they should be answered and that should be raised and also modernized. And second of all, we asked for a second change. You know, there are many people many types of folks that use storage units. Our clients are not the executives that are moving to Minnesota for the high-paying job at 3M. Our clients are victims of domestic violence, victims of sexual assault, and other folks who are simply financially down and out. And under the law, what happens now is if they can't pay, they get locked out of the unit, except for the few things they can take, all of their possessions in life are sold or disposed of. And that's bad enough. But under the current law, they can also then subsequently be taken to court and sued for the deficiency. And we think that makes no sense. Not only is it doesn't make any sense, but it's in some ways really cruel. Because These folks don't have the money to pay. They're not their judgment proof. So now, not only is the storage owner never going to recover the money that they've sued for, add the attorney's fees and the collection costs on top of that, but now our clients have this judgment anvil hanging around their neck to make it even harder to get back on their feet. So what we have proposed since 2014, and we would propose it again today and this year, is that we install a provision, a very limited, narrow exception to the to this structure, and allow for an anti-deficiency provision for people who are victims of violence, recipients of public assistance, are eligible for legal aid. And they would have to document that. We've done the same thing in the ability to break your lease in the event of if you're a victim of violence. We have certain professionals that have to provide certain types of documentation, and we would ask the same thing. So with that, Mr. Chair, my comments are concluded. I would really ask the legislature, as we go to the next stop, to consider these proposals which we have made and the changes which we suggest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Scott,
any just
comments?
A brief response to some of Mr. Elwood's comments. And as most of you know, my husband and I have been in the rental business, the landlord business, for quite some time. And one of the things that we have learned is we know when filing a lawsuit for judgment is whether it's a worthwhile process or not. And when we know that someone is never going to be able to pay that judgment, we don't even file and go through the motions. It's not cost effective for us to do that. And why waste the court's time? Why waste our time to go into court when we know that we're not going to see any of those funds come our way anyway? So I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, I don't know a lot of people in the business that think it's fruitful to pursue a lawsuit or even small claims or whatever and wrap a judgment around somebody's neck that is never going to be able to pay. So I just want to make that clear.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to one thing, Mr. Elwood. You had mentioned that victims of violence are allowed to break their lease because, and so I'm really struggling to equate breaking a lease and leaving all your storage stuff behind, because I understand the breaking lease, right? So they're in danger. They need a new place. And we have actually, Secretary Simon will be here shortly to talk about a great program to further protect them. So I understand that. I'm just struggling to say, so now we need to exempt them from, you know, they leave all their stuff behind. Or and you've actually said that it was a very narrow suggestion, but anybody in public assistance is not a narrow small group of people either. And I forgot the third one you had said, but the victims of violence, particularly, I'm struggling with to equate breaking the lease and then not having this situation happen to them with the rental of the unit. So, and if you could just remind me what the third one was, because I'm not seeing that as a necessarily narrow provision.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Neal, the other one was the eligibility for legal aid services. What I was suggesting actually was that there is already a precedent with respect to having some sort of an exception for certain categories of people and presenting documentation. Because in that bill, in that law, if you are going to seek the breaking of the lease, you have to prove that you are within the eligible category. That was the point I was making. So that we would make an analogy that we would have, you know, certain documentation that would conclude that you were eligible. Otherwise, if you couldn't present that documentation, you wouldn't be eligible. And I think, first of all, I mean, we see in conciliation court, unfortunately, cases where storage folks do sue our clients. I would agree with you. It's probably not a good economic decision. Be that as it may, we see it all the time. In terms of certainly with the analogy with a victim of violence, in some ways, there is a strong analogy, in my opinion, because these are folks who have all their stuff is in this unit. Their whole life is in that unit. And they are really struggling on so many levels. In many cases, their finances are no longer in their control, so even if they want to pay, they can't. And so, you know, I was really only making the analogy in terms of the documentation piece, that we have a precedent to provide documentation. But now that you mention it, actually, I think there is actually, you know, there is some similarity in those two situations where we might want to at least provide some relief for folks that are in terrible situations.
Chair Scott. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative O'Neill.
So, thank you, Chair. Just very quickly. And so I would reiterate the fact that your suggestion of adding victims of violence, all those on public assistance, and anybody eligible for legal aid is not narrow. And that would probably be the majority of the clients of that storage unit.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize to the committee. I took the bait. And that's not what this bill is about. He brought up a sidebar situation that is not, that's not what this bill is about. If Mr. Elwood wants to bring his own bill up, he certainly is at liberty to do that and find a bill author. We're narrowly focused here on a couple of issues, and that's the online auctions and the late fees. So I appreciate the dialogue, and I took the bait myself. So let's get back to the bill if we can.
Thank you to the testifier. Is there anybody else from the audience that, I'm sorry, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. Is it, what was brought up was about the percentages allotted for in certain industries. We kind of had a little conversation over here as to, I see the map, by the way, the map that you have over here showing the rates of, I don't have it, but it's in Packer colors, green and yellow. Yeah, yeah, Packer colors. Bad idea, whoever printed this, okay? Whatever. A lot of these states have 20%.
Patrick's Day color.
But why is it that in the other industries that were talked about, you're looking at 8%, 6%? Why is the storage industry standard so much higher than any other kind of industry where we cap percentages? And I can't remember what it was said. I think for rental housing, what is it, 8%? And then child support is, what, 6%?
I don't know if that was brought up.
Well, they're coming up next. Four? I see four fingers. Okay. So point being, why are you guys so special that you get 20? Maybe there's a good reason for it. I just don't know.
I'll let the testifier who represents the industry address that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, and I will provide feedback to our client on the poor choice of colors, and we'll make sure we're better for the next committee stop.
Mr. For the testifier.
To your question, though, my understanding, yeah, I believe residential or apartment rental rate is indeed capped at 8%. I've asked this question to our client. This has been reflective, I think, of the fact that, and I know we've talked a lot about the range of costs of units. They are just typically the cost of a monthly rent is much lower than a residential rate. And so with your average unit being $150 to $150, the now $15, 15% here, but 2020 in many other states has been kind of the place where the operators feel that for the serious problem they deal with of delinquent payments on all size units, and all the activities that triggers with respect to notifications and processes, that is the kind of the sweet spot where they are able to recover those costs.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how do you respond to legal aid when they say that Minnesota case law is very clear that you don't get to charge a late fee? It's supposed to cover your cost. It's not supposed to punish. It's not to incentivize. So how do you respond that $79 on a $300 unit is a legitimately cost of doing business rather than a punishment or?
I was going to say.
Representative Chair Scott.
Thank you. Court costs are the same wherever you go, regardless of what you're suing for.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But we're not at court costs yet. We're just at late fees.
Yes.
This isn't once you file. This is they want to be able to charge it every month on whether or not you're paying. So notification, right, calling them or sending them a letter, whatever you have to do to notify them that they're late, right? How do you justify that $79 is your monthly charge for notification if our Minnesota case law says you can't do it for punishment and you can't do it for incentivization? What documentation do you have that that's what it costs?
To testify.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't have clear documentation for you right now. I will certainly follow up to get that to you. I sense that this all stems from that same problem of the extremes, the very expensive mm-hmm. units and the very inexpensive units. And so I think we're moving towards trying to find a solution to address those concerns. And I think by doing that, we might also address this very good question.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Well, and I just want to follow up with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can ask in small claims court for your cost of recovery. So the percentage should not necessarily reflect the static cost of recovery as referenced by Representative Scott, because you can get those as part of your claim. So if when you get those questions answered, you can address that as well. I appreciate it.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify on House File 3380? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing portion. Member questions. Anybody from the committee? Seeing no further questions, Chair Scott renews her motion to move this to Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All in favor?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We took up the amendment, but we never really talked about whether there was agreement whether to vote on it or not. And so I wanted to pitch that back out to the committee. I know it didn't meet deadline. The amendment is to lower it from 2020 to 1515. So I didn't know, Representative Lesh, if he's amenable to go ahead and taking a vote on the amendment, or if we wanted to take that up in Commerce, or just what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I have no objection to taking that up. I'm not necessarily going to speak for all my members, but I think I probably can in this instance. No objection.
Okay. With that in mind, we will vote on the A1 amendment. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The A1 is adopted.
A little love in that one.
Okay. Chair Scott, any closing words before we vote on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good bill. It's a work in progress. I know I'm willing to work with the stakeholders, Mr. Elwood and so forth, and I know that the amendment was an effort to meet them partway. We'll continue talking and see if we can't satisfy most people.
Thank you. So, all those in favor of the amended motion to move on to Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. No. Motion carries. It's on its way to Commerce.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary and Representative Lohmer.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Morning.
Welcome to the committee. The file before us is 3551. Representative Pugh moves House File 3551, and the referral would be to the Public Safety and Security Policy Committee. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 3551 is the Safe at Home Administration Bill. Safe at Home is an address confidentiality program administered by the Office of Secretary of State. Safe at Home was created in 2006 to protect victims of stalking, domestic violence, sexual assault, and others who fear for their safety. Minnesota is one of over 30 states with similar programs. Minnesota's Safe at Home program currently serves over 2,600 individuals, representing over 1,000 households. The program works by giving participants a legal substitute address, a post office box, to use in place of their physical address. This address can be used whenever an address is required. As the Safe at Home program passed the 10-year mark, the program is proposing an administrative bill that would address issues that have come up over the lifetime of the program. This is a technical bill that has resulted from years of feedback from those interacting with the Safe at Home program and is intended to provide more clarity and transparency to the program. Secretary of State Steve Simon is here and can walk the members through the bill and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Secretary Simon, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all members of the committee for accommodating our schedules and flipping things around. Some of you know from personal experience, sometimes it's not persuasive to five-year-olds and three-year-olds that dad's got a committee hearing, and so that accounts in part for the lateness, so I appreciate that. I want to thank Representative Lohmer for her leadership on this and for authoring the bill. As she mentioned, this is an aggregation of very technical items. Madam Chair, we met with you and other members of the committee and members in both chambers, and we said all along, if any member feels that any item here is not technical and you want it yanked or want it to run alone, we can do that. No one's done that. We've met with the courts. We've met with prosecutors. We've met with the domestic violence advocates and, of course, legislators. So we believe these are all clarifications and technical. I won't do a line-by-line recitation, Madam Chair, but I thought it might be a useful thing just to hit the highlights. The first thing the bill does is add a requirement that participants provide our office with a date of birth on the application. This is private data in our control, so no one else will get this. But fortunately or unfortunately, we have enough people in the program now, which is a mixed blessing. It's good that people are taking advantage of it. It's sad that so many people need this service. We have enough people in the program that we're starting to see people with the same name, you know, two or three Jennifer Andersons, let's say. And so it becomes important to have some other distinguishing feature like date of birth so we can tell which Jennifer Anderson is the right one. The second provision would clarify that the program participation is not evidence that an underlying crime or conduct occurred. This is very important. It was never our intention, but it's come up in a couple court proceedings. We wanted to clarify. Evidence of enrollment in the program is only evidence of enrollment in the program. It's not evidence that anyone did anything. It can't be used in a court of law as a sword, so to speak, by anyone. We just wanted to clarify that. That was always the intent. Third, we wanted to clarify that when a participant must inform the office that they have a change in their personal information, so they have to inform us of a change to their legal name, address, or telephone number. That seems obvious, but we wanted to just put clarifying language in there so that there's no question about that. Fourth, we want to clarify that a participant may only have one substitute address. That's the very idea of the program, that all mail has to be sent using that substitute address. That's the building block of the program. We just want to put it in statute. And then finally, I would say the fifth significant item is that it allows our office to share participant substitute address, not the real address, but the substitute address, and that address is designed to be public for all purposes, the substitute address, the P.O. box, you know, 123, et cetera. Obviously not the underlying address. That's the whole idea of the program. That, too, we thought had been obvious, but we just want to put clarifying language in there. So this is, ironically, after nearly 11 years in service, this is the first truly technical bill that the program has had. There have been other sort of policy-related bills, but this is just a more or less a laundry list of things that have come up in recent years that we think require clarification. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the committee members, and I'd like to thank Representative Lohmer for her leadership on this issue.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Are there any questions on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I think hopefully these technical changes will help the program run more efficiently. With that, let's see. Representative Pugh renews her motion that, that House File 3551 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Security Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, members.
Good morning, Representative Scott, Madam Chair. Would you like to move, or would you like me to move House File 3380? Oh, 3295.
I can move House File 3295.
Representative Scott moves House File 3295 before the committee and recommends that it be re-referred to the Public Safety and Security Policy Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. That is the motion. And members, right now in current law, a married couple that's going to family court to get a divorce can file a joint petition. And that allows them to kind of have a pre-negotiated agreement. And they go to court, and they still appear before a judge and are able to move through the process more quickly, more efficiently, with less money spent, hopefully, by filing these joint petitions. As we know, with so many out-of-wedlock births in the state of Minnesota and across the nation, a lot of child custody issues are not the child is not born where the divorce is the case and there's a availability for a joint petition. And so what we've done here is we've just said, you know, unmarried parents should have the same ability to have this joint petition. And so that is what this bill does. It sets up the outline for that, for unmarried people to file a joint petition. It still has to be blessed by the judge. And so that's kind of the synopsis of what this bill does. And I do have people standing by to give technical assistance. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And I do see we have a question on the bill. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I'll ask you on this one and then each of the subsequent bills. Was this part of that working group, and is there full consensus of that working group? Up until this point, we haven't been passing family law bills unless they have come out of that group. So can you tell me kind of the history of where this came from and who agrees on this bill?
You know, thank you. I'll have one of these people come up, and we've agreed on some stuff, but I don't remember if this was one of them or not. But I think more so these bills that I have today are more technical bills from the department, but they're certainly bills that I would think are bipartisan, and they've been worked out with legal aid and the department and so forth. And I think they're really positive moves. So I wouldn't necessarily say that they were, because what the child support work group right now is doing, or task force, is we're more focused on what should go into the table, the basic table, those sorts of things. We haven't nibbled around the edges on this sort of stuff, but I'll let one of the testifiers speak.
Thank you, Representative Scott, and thank you for coming to the testifying table. Please state your name and proceed your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Representative Hillstrom, the dialogue group that met a few years ago, this was not something that we discussed in this group, so it's not something that's different when the group decided. It's something that's just outside of what we were working on there. Legal Aid, I want to thank Representative Scott, too. We have looked thoroughly at this bill. We support this bill. I think it's a good way for unmarried parents who can work things out to have kind of an expedited way to do that and through the court system and get approval. And so we want to encourage that to happen when we can get parents to work together.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. And follow-up, Representative Hillstrom? Okay. Thank you. And Representative Smith, question?
Madam Chair, I will wait until after the testifier. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. It doesn't look like there is any more testimony. Representative Smith, if you have your question.
Madam Chair, thank you. Where did you say this is going to be re-referred to?
Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy. Public Safety, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, are you sure?
Representative Smith, that's a good question. I'm going to ask Chair Scott or staff. That is what I have been informed. That is the correct committee, I have been assured by staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Smith. Representative Scott.
I'm sorry that I put you in this position, Madam Chair, to be hazed by another member.
I forgive you, Representative Scott, and I will think about forgiving Representative Smith. Is there anybody else from the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the motion to send House File 3295 to the Public Safety Committee, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to public safety. All right, so Representative Scott, if you'd like to present your next bill.
Madam Chair, would that be House File 3389 or 3406?
I have 3406 next, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill says that...
Representative Scott, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 3406.
Okay, Representative Scott moves House File 3406 and recommends that it be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you. Minnesota statute allows courts to count income for child support purposes even if a parent is not earning that income, and that's called imputed or potential income. And what this bill does is it says that you can't use imputed income against people that are on general assistance where the payer is on general assistance or SSI, and there shouldn't be any imputation of income for incarcerated child support payers when they are incarcerated for non-payment of child support. And that is a federal law, so that section of the bill is just getting us up to compliance with the federal law. And the other portion is just, I can give you some more information on that. Eligibility requirements for GA and SSI are closely related to the inability to work, especially when eligibility criteria rely on a disability. And a recipient of GA or SSI must navigate the eligibility system in order to receive their benefit, including providing evidence for their eligibility. A recipient of GA or SSI often has fewer tools and resources available to them than the average child support litigant. The same facts that lead to their eligibility in those programs present logistical challenges when interacting with government systems, including the child support system. Recipients of GA and SSI may have to twice prove the same facts to two different agencies, first for benefits for eligibility and then for child support. So this bill makes an exception to Minnesota's child support income imputation statute so that we would add GA and SSI recipients, that we would add that they are presumed to be unable to work and therefore do not have income imputed. And because eligibility for these programs do not always match exactly with the inability to work, the presumptions should be rebuttable. And the solution will alleviate the burden of GA and SSI recipients to prove their inability to work twice and may result in lower orders for some obligors. So that's, in essence, the rationale behind it.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Are there any questions for Representative Scott? Just there for questions? Okay, so is there anybody from the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none, is there any discussion on the bill? If not, those in favor of the motion to send House File 3406 to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 3406 is on its way to Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Scott, you have another bill up, House File 3389. Would you like to move House File 3389 to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That's the motion before the committee. Representative Scott, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3389 is in regard to modification of child support. In 2015, we passed a law, several laws, regarding family law, and one of those was to include an income expense adjustment so that both parents would have a credit when the child is with them, because obviously when the child is with you, you have more expenses than when they're not, or theoretically. So that income expense adjustment goes into effect in August of this year. And there's a couple things at play here that brought this bill about. First of all, a statute we believed was unclear as to the bar that had to be reached in order for a person to get into court to actually file for modification. And the bar is a 20% or 20% and 75 dollar difference in their child support. So and there's a further in current law basic it's unclear let me draw your attention to the line that we're striking. Okay, so what does it say? I'm gonna have my testifier explain it. And there's a court case that goes along with this that really also is a reason for bringing this bill so that we can clarify what the bar is for people to get into court for modification.
Okay, thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Hillstrom, is it all right if we have the testifier share? Do you have a question for Representative Scott?
Well, I was just going to shorten it for Representative Scott. This is codifying case law, and we don't have any objection to it. So if you want to go on for a long time, you can, but otherwise.
Representative Scott?
Well, I would like to get on the record the case law that we're referring to so that members and the public are aware of why the change is being made.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Scott. And please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jennifer Sommerfeld, the Legislative Director of Children and Family Services of the Department of Human Services. This bill, you're correct, Representative Hillstrom, it does codify case law. There's a case, Rose v. Rose, out there that clarifies that people who have a change in their child support obligation due solely to a change in the law are able to modify it if they meet the threshold that's in statute of 20% and $75. This bill kind of came through the Child Support Task Force that's meeting right now. That task force took a lot of public testimony this year, and it was very clear that members of the public and, frankly, even family law attorneys were not aware of the case law, so this simply makes that more clear for them.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Scott, any further comments on your bill?
No, I'd like to renew my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anybody from the audience who wishes to testify on the bill before we proceed to vote? Okay, seeing none, Representative Scott renews her motion that we re-refer House File 3389 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 3389 is on its way to the General Register.
Madam Chair, while you're making your way back up to the gavel, I would ask if we could take up 2309 first, electronic tracking warrants, because I think we may be able to get through that in 15 minutes, but we'll not be able to get through with 1316 in 15 minutes. Is that okay with you?
That's fine with me.
Okay.
Representative Lesh, would you like to move House File 2309?
I would, Madam Chair. Where is it going?
The referral is to Public Safety and Security Policy. Representative
Lesh. Okay. Madam Chair, House File 2309 is designed to address a little snafu that has occurred within the courts whereby the tracking warrants that we passed as part of the 2013 session, it was somewhere
14
was to ensure that the contents of those tracking warrants became public after 90 days. It quickly became apparent that the courts were not releasing the results of those tracking warrants, which we found out about a year later. And after some investigation with the courts, it was determined that because of the common practices of law enforcement where they put
everything in one warrant with every justification, that the courts defaulted in favor of not making those warrants public, which was our legislative clear intent, but there was no way for the courts, at least according to the courts, to split that baby and say, okay, this part of the warrant public is public. This part with the pen register, a trap and trace, was not public. So this language is intended to clarify that and say that no, that you have to make sure that the legislative intent to make these tracking warrants public would be public. We believe that this language fixes that. I did have a conversation with Drew Evans, superintendent of the BCA, who said, yeah, we expect that it would be public too. We have no objection to it being public. And the language before you is the language I had from last year, which the BCA had no objection to. Since then, there have been several back and forths with Madam Chair yourself and with Rich Neumeister. I don't know, Rich, I don't see Rich here today. I think he's been busy this session. I only saw him in here once, actually, this session, Madam Chair. There were suggestions about how we fix it further, including the amendment that was put forward, making clear that administrative subpoenas shall not be issued to collect other information. Why don't we just take some testimony on this, if we can, from, I think, Mr. Feist is here from the ACLU. But it's important to me that this fixed language get through this session to make sure that the legislative intent is reflected in what the courts are doing. But maybe we want to hear from other folks on this amendment language, too. So I'm not offering this amendment language quite yet, Madam Chair.
Okay. Very fine, Representative Lesch. Please step forward, Mr. Feist. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I first want to thank Representative Lesch for bringing this forward this year and for the Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Privacy for talking about this issue and the problems that we've seen in the report since this bill was passed. The ACLU worked pretty hard at making sure that we got a law in place requiring tracking warrants back in 2014. And the main reason for that was simply that the new technologies allow for very invasive tracking of location of where you're at based on your cell phone. And that's both in real time and historic tracking that can happen that way. So by setting something out in state law specifically talking about figuring out where somebody's cell phone was, we wanted to make sure that we had all the main hallmarks of a search warrant with the understanding from law enforcement that there are some ways that the traditional search warrant wouldn't work. Through the rest of the process, we also knew it was critical to make sure that there was transparency in the process because we didn't have a real sense on whether there were 50 of these tracking warrants issued a year or 500. As things currently stand, we were disappointed to see the report from court administration come out that was really kind of a mess in terms of what the public can now know about how this is happening. So we very much support the idea of coming in and making sure that we have adequate reporting of how these are working and notice. As far as we can tell, these are all being sealed and people aren't getting the notice that was built into the original statute. And again, that's really critical because if law enforcement, for example, decided to get a tracking warrant to see where I'm going every day at the Capitol and later they find that there's no actual case against me, after 90 days, I should know that under our law. But as things currently stand, they could have been doing that, and I would not know that. So that's what we're hoping to achieve. The actual language, I understand that the BCA and perhaps others in law enforcement have some concerns with the author's amendment, but we're happy to continue working on this to make sure that we get language that works for everyone.
If people want to take up and have a conversation about the author's amendment, we can do that. There are additional provisions in there, including that the folks disclosing or making public the tracking warrant is the law enforcement agency as opposed to the judge. You know, I guess I feel like it's the judge making the decision about what to make public, and I feel like it should. I kind of feel like it should be the judge that's doing that. But also, it says that you can't lump these together. The counter practice of law enforcement. Law enforcement would probably bristle at that. I expect, because that's what the way they've always done it. So we can have a conversation about that. But I feel like we should get this language in clean first before we have that discussion. And second, before I knew about this language, Madam Chair, I did have this conversation with Drew Evans, and we kind of reached an agreement. He said, yeah, I wouldn't object to making clear that this was our intent. Let's make that happen. And so I kind of feel an obligation to honor that. The results of that conversation from, I don't even know when that was, like November or something, before we move on to these additional areas. But if folks want to talk about it, we can.
Any discussion among members? Representative Lesh, we took this issue up in the Data Commission, and we did cite the two kind of problems that we've seen since the bill or since the law became law. And one was, you know, the disclosure of what Mr. Feist was talking about. And the other is this fact that law enforcement files many, many kind of let's see what'll stick as far as when they're filing warrants before the courts. And my understanding at the time that the legislation was passed in 2014 was that we wanted just a tracking warrant. We didn't want the tracking warrant thrown in with the kitchen sink. We wanted the tracking warrant to be filed separately. And I still am a proponent of addressing that in the amendment. So I'd like to continue the discussion. I think because I know there are some people that believe that this bill is going to be heard this evening, and they're not here to testify, I think we're going to lay it over until this evening and finish taking it up at that time. And but I also wanted to make an opportunity for anybody else in the audience that wished to testify right now that is here, obviously, that doesn't want to come back this evening, to testify in it now if they wish.
And while folks are making their way down, Madam Chair, I think I recall the day that the Data Practices Commission had that meeting, I was in trial, so I missed that.
Oh, okay.
So I may not have heard the discussion that went on regarding that. Apologize for missing that.
That's all right. So it doesn't seem like there's anybody else in the audience. So with that, we will lay the bill over. I know rules needs to get in here and set up for the next committee. Thank you, members. We're in recess. We will call the Civil Law and Data Practices hearing from this morning back to order. And we're in the middle of hearing House File 2309, Representative Lesh's bill on tracking warrants. And I knew that there were possibly some testifiers that thought that we were meeting on it tonight, and so I wanted to give them the opportunity to weigh in on the issue, and so that is one of the reasons we came back. And so with that, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 2309? Hello, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, if I need to move the amendment in order to have the conversation, because I think Mr. Neumeister is going to be speaking to the amendment. So
right.
In order to have that conversation, I move the amendment, the 0614 amendment.
All righty. We will, the amendment entitled, what did you call it?
The 614.
A18-614 is before us. We'll hear the testimony and then go from there. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the Civil Law Committee and Privacy Committee, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I'm testifying in regards as a privacy advocate and open government advocate. It was only several years ago, in the fall of 2013, it was discovered by the public by doing data requests that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension had high-tech tools where they would be able to track folks based on phones or whatever or size it may be in their pocket. The legislators nor the public knew about this. Since over the last 10 years, up through this year, the BCA has spent nearly $1 million on these two devices. They're cellular exploitive devices called Stingray. Now, nobody knew about it until Representative Lesch and some of the colleagues back then, Mary Liz Holberg, bipartisan, asked for a little bit more detail. And that's where we found out things. Also at that time, and what a Stingray is a device that mimics a cell phone tower that law enforcement has and can track your personal device in your pocket. We also became aware of at that time that a lot of folks were tracking location data, other than just using devices, but law enforcement was finding out about where we're going or whatever because of the new technology. But also at that time, we found out that law enforcement was using 30-year-old law, not a Fourth Amendment probable cause standard, not even, some would say, not a reasonable suspicion standard, but a reason to believe, or it might be relevant to an investigation or whatever. And so what the legislature did is pass a law that basically said anytime law enforcement needs to know where you're at, location data, whether it be at the Verizon for historical information, where was Rich Neumeister 3 months ago based on pings using cell towers? Can you give us an idea? Or in real time using these kind of devices called Stingray, you're going to have to go through a tracking warrant. Now, the devices that I was talking to you about, like the Stingray, they have a lot of software and add-ons to it. That's where some of the $1 million has spent on, and law enforcement does not want to share this information with at least with the public. But some of the hardware that these folks may have, that other entities throughout the country have, are things called fishhook, porpoise, and similar names, which can intercept communications and text messages, and specifically locate devices, you know, as very, very clear, you know, very near to where you are. So we found out that Hennepin County had a kingfish, BCA had stingrays. Now, what the legislature did, and it was law enforcement, and then with a lot of the other folks who wanted, you know, a Fourth Amendment kind of thing, one proposal was to do a search warrant. It's very clear what a search warrant is. Law enforcement balked at that. Let's have a tracking warrant, something that we've never, it's most states I don't think have, but was something that was created. The thing was is that we were one of the first states to ever do this kind of legislation, ever. You know, a lot of states have followed since then. And so what was happening as this was placed into law, there were a number of provisions put into law that there would be a probable cause, there would be a tracking warrant, and thirdly, that the subject, and there's thousands of tracking warrants probably now that have been done. Based on the last report, there's a two-year report on this one. There are probably about 1,000 plus. Now with the new report coming up in 2018, there could be probably more. I'm taking an educated guess. So there's 1,000 plus, 2,000, maybe 2,000 of these tracking warrants. But one of the things is the subjects were going to be notified, and the warrant would become public for public to oversee how law enforcement does that. Well, the point is that none of these are public. None of the subjects have been notified, which was the intent of this legislature that passed unanimously. Except maybe, I don't know. I think it was unanimous, maybe one vote against or whatever. But the bottom line, since 2014, when the law took effect, there have been reports, news media coverage, and all those kinds of things that have highlighted some of the points that I just wanted to raise, and then I'll talk about in the amendment. from Channel 9. We've learned many judges didn't fully understand what they were signing, which is this. Supposedly a tracking warrant, but it's not just a tracking warrant. It's for other court orders, too. And so they learned that many judges didn't fully understand what they were signing to protect your rights to independently review whether or not the law enforcement request to track where you were going or are going or what you did 10 months ago raised that threshold of Fourth Amendment, which I think we still all believe in. What statute applies to tracking warrants that judges didn't know because they were being confused by a confusing court order or what technology was being used. Another aspect of the report that was said, but the report also, now this is a report that came out every 2 years I was telling you about, tells you how many of these tracking warrants are being done. The report reveals that the vast majority of those warrants aren't being applied for under an older provision of law, which is a lesser standard, not a Fourth Amendment standard, that doesn't specify what device is used, only requires reasonable suspicion a crime has been committed, and the court order remains permanently sealed. So since all those reports start Tribune, there was just a recent report in the Duluth newspaper on these things, this is what the amendment would deal with. And that's what I want to share with you what those provisions are. If you look at subdivisions 1 and 2, it says that administrative subpoenas shall not be issued to collect location information. Now, based on data requests, and one of the devil's data requests have been by Tony Webster, who's done a lot of data requests on facial recognition and things like this. We found this out about Hennepin County Sheriffs. They call it CISA, their little investigative intel kind of division. It's called CISA. CISA routinely does analysis on suspect cell phone records usage. HCSO investigators frequently issues cell phone subpoenas on suspects, violent offenders, who have an active warrant or PC pickup. Once investigators have a subpoena submitted to the cell carrier, which would be Verizon or AT&T or whatever, the carrier will then email the location, the latitude and longitude to the investigator and CISA every 15 minutes. CISA then monitors the location pings and relays the information to investigators who are out in the field trying to locate the suspect. Completely, from my point of view, contrary to what the state law says. I have looked at hundreds of subpoenas when this bill came up in 2013 and 2014 from Dakota County, from Ramsey County, from Anoka County, Hennepin County. They gave me all their logs, but they didn't give me their subpoenas, and I've looked at their thousands of logs since then through 2016. And even in the administrative subpoenas, they're asking for cell phone location, pings, whatever you want to call it, information through administrative subpoenas. This was gotten from by Tony Webster in 2016. This is that I asked Tony how was this dated, and it was probably right around 2015, a year after the law was done. So what sections 1 and 2 do is basically say what the intent of the legislature was. If you're going to get location data on anybody, you're not going to use an administrative subpoena, which you can get through a county attorney, which is at a lower threshold and is basically at irrelevant to an investigation. Section 3 is basically the recommendation of the Privacy Commission, because why these court orders are not public and available for us to oversee this use of this kind of technology and the kind of things that they do, law enforcement, for our privacy and accountability, is that one entity said, well, this law trumps the new law, which is 626A 42, and another folks said, no, this is not the case, da-da-da-da-da, we got to do that. So that's why basically none of the things have been available to the public. Now, if you go to sections 4 and 5, 30 years ago, and again, I've been around long enough, I was involved in the legislation at 626A39, section 4. Mobile tracking device. In the mid-80s, law enforcement was putting on vehicles what they called bird dogs. If you remember that Goldfinger, James Bond, you know, how he had the little thing and he put the thing on, the, you know, and then you could see from his Aston Martin where the car was going. Well, they're known as bird dogs back then in the mid-80s. And so we were one of the states that did not have where you needed to have a court order to do it. So what happened when this law, you know, I was involved with the policymakers at that time to put that provision in, and it was mobile tracking device, which was the intent. You put the thing on the vehicle, which is basically how it is. And that's what a mobile tracking device is. And then it's basically the law enforcement's or the cop's mobile tracking device. And then you can follow wherever it is. Now, why this language is added in here, because what is happening, based on the reports and other things, is that law enforcement is using this definition of a mobile tracking device, which is a lower threshold, in a confused court order that judges may not know about or clearly ideal about. And I've talked to several judges myself on that. And even to a point where with some judges, I was told that Hennepin County had a workshop just last year on this particular issue. So it's making clear that this is under the custody or control of law enforcement. It goes back to the original intent. Now, in 626A42, this is the electronic device. This is your cell phone or any kind of device that you might have where there can be location tracking data. This is clearly to make sure that it's not a government tracking device. It's your own personal device. So it's just there to clearly differentiate that if you're going to follow, you know, don't confuse a personal cell phone with an old law that was for only the one which you put on your car, which is a lower standard, because with when it's in your pocket, your cell phone, it's with a probable cause, a Fourth Amendment kind of threshold. It may sound confusing, but when you're talking about rights, this is an important thing. So that was added language. If you go on to section 6, as I indicated to you, there's been confusion by the judiciary how to do this by various reports, my own discussion, and those kinds of things here, and what other states have done since then. We learned from what other states have done. They've basically said, if you're going to do location data, do it with a location tracking warrant or the document itself. Don't confuse it with pen registers, trap and trace devices, mobile tracking devices, whatever. Make it clear. And for those people who may not know what pen register and trap and trace device are, trap and trace is when someone calls you, and pen register is when you dial out. So again, old language based on landlines, but it's language that's being used for modern technology. And it's very clear that's why it should be separate, shouldn't be confused, or whatever, dealing with the number location. And so that's why that language is in there. Section 7. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, whether or not this amendment will pass or not, I have no idea, or be withdrawn.
I articulate these issues to you because these are important issues, and I've been ups and downs on these issues historically. Sometimes, you know, there's time to do it, sometimes there's not, but I think these issues need to be addressed. But if the original bill is going to leave as is, and what the intent is to make clear that these court orders or tracking warrants are public and available to the public, one other thing it needs to pass on with that original bill is something to do with the stricken language on pages line 426 through 431. This particular language was a mishmash of language because there was a lot of pushback by law enforcement who did not want a lot of these court orders to be public or tracking warrants to be public, similar to what wiretap language is. They're just trying to do the same thing. And so that language you see there is a combination of court rules 330, I think it is, and some other things like that. So what it allows is the county prosecutor, hey, we don't want this stuff to be public. We don't want it to be filed, because if it's not filed, the intent of the law for things to be public, for the subjects to be notified, will not happen. So the county attorney says to the judge, hey, you know, we want all this stuff not to be filed. An order must be issued granting the request in whole or in part, you know, and whatever. So all of a sudden you got this tracking warrant and supporting documents not available. The only way that it can be released, if it's in that pocket, if it's in that sort of bag somewhere, is you go to the next language on lines 5-1 through 5-6. The tracking warrant must direct that following the commencement of any criminal proceeding utilizing evidence obtained in or as a result of the search in regards to the tracking warrant, then it shall be filed. But the bottom line is some of those things that may never happen to that. There may never be any kind of criminal commencement of any criminal proceeding against somebody. They may have gotten evidence. They may have, well, you know, we're not going to charge, we're not going to do anything. So where are the missing court orders? Where are the tracking warrants that you 4 years ago said should be public and subjects get notified? Educated guess is that a number of them are there, too, in that pocket, other than the misunderstanding of what the law is. So if the original bill is going to move as is, I think if you're not going to strike this language, put in a trigger that says that it cannot be permanently filed forever. That the subjects have a right to know if you were asking for their location data, whether it be by a Stingray device or whether it be for historical kinds of things, historical data. So that's my two cents, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I know, you know, it was a detailed kind of thing, but when you deal with technology and when you deal with rights, it is a detailed kind of thing. And it's one of the things that why over the years I'd like to get into these kinds of things. I've helped develop a lot of these laws with policymakers. I encourage you to adopt the amendment to continue on the discussion, because I think it needs to be smoked out a little bit, but that's up to you. But at least if that does not happen and the original bill goes as is, I think it's important to address that trigger concept so that there not be a permanent pocket where tracking warrants are placed.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any questions for the testifier? I thank you for going through the amendment with members. Mr. Neumeister. I agree that probably the language in the current bill is probably not as strong as we would like it to be to accomplish what we want to accomplish. And so I hope that, I know that this bill is being referred to public safety. I hope that Representative Lesch will work on some language that will actually get us closer to what we want, to what the public is entitled to see, to what the original bill's intent was. So I would really like to see Representative Lesch and Mr. Neumeister and the folks from the BCA or whoever that, you know, need to be brought into the conversation, would be brought into the conversation, and there to, that there would be some changes made so that we can get at the original intent of the bill even more closely than what this bill language does. So with that, Representative Lesch, any comments, any do you want to continue to offer the amendment? Do you want, what do you want to do with the amendment?
Madam Chair, I agree with a lot of what Mr. Neumeister said. I think there should be ongoing conversations about this, because the reason we're in this position now is we passed language originally that we thought was adequate, and clearly based on practice, it wasn't. So if, based upon Mr. Neumeister's statements, we pass this language to fix it, and it still doesn't fix it based on the actions of the court, we're going to be back again, which would frustrate me, but it wouldn't be the first time I've been frustrated around here. So I would say that despite that, I introduced this bill originally a year ago, and here we are today really kind of having the first meaningful discussion about it with language that members of the committee had seen for the first time. So based on that, and then my conversation with the superintendent of the BCA a couple months ago, saying he said he was okay with the language as is, I feel somewhat obligated to move forward based on that understanding and agreement to do the fix and then have this conversation about this other language. If that's between now and public safety, yeah, if we can do that, if we can engage people, I'd be interested in having that conversation. But for today, I will withdraw the amendment, ask that we pass the fix, and then have the conversation ongoing from here hereafter.
All right. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, would you allow me to give a point on that, if I may?
Yeah, quickly, okay. If you can.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and that's my impression of what's probably going to happen, and that's why I strongly recommend you can do away with the rest of the amendment, which I think are legitimate issues to be discussed, could be, they should be addressed now. But the one, if you really still want that true fix, Madam Chair and Representative Lesch and Civil Committee, you need to address that language in 626A42 subdivision 4 with some kind of trigger. Because this language, if you look at the history of this language, it came from the House. The Senate had no idea about it. It was just really strongly for law enforcement. And if you look at the Channel 9 story that they did on this, it was a 10-minute piece, the first one, you'll see it was all the intent to make these public and the subject know. But if that, this little thing is not resolved with some type of trigger, that eventually a lot of things would still remain secret. So of all the things, that is still one that I think that's an item that can be legitimately discussed as it continues its journey. And I hope that committee and Representative Lesch are open to that.
I'd leave it to the committee. If the committee wants to include that in, I'll go with that. I tend to look at the complicated nature of what we're talking about, and I tend to think it probably requires a longer conversation with more stakeholders being heard on it than we're going to have tonight.
Right.
So I'm hesitant at moving forward with any component of the amendment, at least tonight.
Madam Chair, and that's the point I was just trying to say. I hope that policymakers are open for that little trigger fix of that little section.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we can take just a portion of the amendment.
No, and I don't think we can deal with it here, but I just wanted to get it on record.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. With that, Representative Lesch withdrew the A18. and we will go ahead and take a vote on the full bill. Was there anyone else that had any comments? All right, very good. Was that my vote? Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 2309 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. Thank you, Representative Lesh. And the final bill is House File 1316. Oh, members, the Smith bill has been removed from the agenda. Representative Lesh to House File 1316.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the path for this? What's the motion?
This will be going to the General Register, Representative Lesh.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, House File 1316 is a bill that has generated substantial input from various stakeholders. Minnesota Coalition on Government Information and various other individuals, including the Minnesota Newspaper Association, observed problems associated with the accessibility of video and audio recordings that really ought to be public. And so language was crafted to try to address this. And Madam Chair, we had a hearing on this last year that resulted in a stakeholder meeting that was one of the most interesting meetings I've participated in my time here at the legislature. It wasn't terribly productive, but folks had their say. I would say that in the year since that meeting occurred, there has not been a ton of discussion between now and then. So I thank the chair for bringing this forward, because without having the hearings, there's no reason to have ongoing discussion, because the those with the stake in the status quo are sated. So I would offer this for several reasons. One, including the attorney for the Newspaper Association, Mark Anfinson, was engaged in that meeting, as well as many other stakeholders were on behalf of the disclosure advocates. And one of the chief proponents on the opposition was Mr. Brian Rice, who represented several public employee unions, but who is not here today. Because of family illness, critical family illness. So I spoke with Mr. Rice this morning, and based on Mr. Rice's unavailability to engage on this, I personally am uncomfortable in moving this bill to the General Register tonight without further stakeholder meetings to try to sand the edges off this, Madam Chair, because we will surely have problems in the future. So what I'm asking for is this, is that the stakeholders who are here come forward, state their concerns clearly on the record about the problems they have with certain components of the bill. We will hereafter schedule another stakeholder meeting, at which point we will take up the issues, concerns, favorable impressions of folks who speak on it tonight, so that we don't have a kitchen sink discussion at the stakeholder meeting. And then it will be my request of the chair that this bill be laid over until we have that stakeholder discussion. So that's my intent of how to move forward on this with your indulgence, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, thank you for that. Will the stakeholder meeting be able to take place in the next few days? Because we have bill deadlines to meet.
We do, Madam Chair. I think it's important enough that, first of all, we get this scheduled immediately or very quickly. But it's important enough that if we cannot for some reason, that we will go to rules and attempt to get this moved after deadlines.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Lesh, how do you intend to take care of the issues that those that couldn't be here tonight, Mr. Anfinson's not here tonight, Mr. Rice isn't here, how do you intend to deal with the issues that aren't placed on the record for their absence?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, this is a publicly noticed meeting. I have had conversations with a couple of people who I know have concerns, including Mr. Rice.
but I'm not going to go on to the fields and hedgerows to solicit input from anyone who may not have been heard. I expect that the issues placed on the record tonight will be the issues that we will discuss in the stakeholder meeting.
All right, let's hear from the stakeholders. So you're not, are you going to offer any of these amendments, Representative Lash?
I will offer them for the purposes of discussion, Madam Chair. But if we're not, I mean, yes, to the extent that the stakeholders have come forward are going to speak to them, I will offer the amendments.
All right. So the A18, 0611, and 0610 are two of the amendments, and then there's the A2. So those are all open for discussion this evening. So if you're here to testify on behalf of this bill, regarding this bill, please come forward. Oh, we have a list.
Yeah.
On my sheet. Mr. Ealing, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. HF 1316 has been brought forward to address the outcome of a 2016 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, a decision that resulted in some uncertainty about access to certain video data maintained by government entities. At issue in that Supreme Court case were video recordings captured by a Metro Transit bus surveillance camera. On those recordings, an altercation between a bus driver and a visually impaired passenger were captured. KSTP-TV filed a Data Practices Act request to obtain a copy of that video footage, but it was turned away by Metro Transit, which claimed that the video was classified as personnel data and thus private and not accessible to the media or the public as data requesters. Now, for background, there is no general overall classification for video data under Minnesota law in Chapter 13. Thus, the general presumption that the Data Practices Act governs, or excuse me, the general presumption in the Data Practices Act that government data default to a public status applies, and the video in this situation should have been released. Now, personnel data is a classification of government data that, in practical terms, has been viewed as data utilized in the context of employment matters, including employee compensation, the terms of employment, and so forth. In the Data Practices Act, personnel data works the opposite from most other data, in that all personnel data is presumed to be private, except for a specific list of public data that's spelled out in Minnesota Statutes 13.43. So KSTP sued for access to the footage, and they successfully argued that the bus video was not personnel data as defined by the statute. They prevailed at the administrative court level. They prevailed at the Court of Appeals. At the Supreme Court, a mixed decision was rendered, and the court ruled that the video was public in one context when it was maintained on the bus camera's hard drive, but that it was personnel data when it was copied onto a DVD and used to review employee conduct, and thus not accessible to a data requester. Now, from a practical standpoint, the court's ruling can pose some confusion and problems for access to important government data, and let me provide an example to illustrate. So given the court's ruling, you could have video existing on the bus hard drive, which the court said is public information, while the exact same video exists on a DVD in a personnel file, which the court said is not public. Now, to add an additional complication, Metro Transit, their bus hard drives are auto-erased every 330 hours, meaning that if the public copy on the hard drive was destroyed, but the not public copy on the DVD continued to exist, then you could no longer get access to that information, even though it had been public prior to the hard drive erasure. To us, that seems to be a pretty arbitrary matter of timing, and thus that's why we want to bring this bill forward, and we're pleased that Representative Lesch has been open to our concerns on this matter. After the court ruled in the KSTP case, I would note that KSTP-TV, they were able to access the public copy on the bus hard drive, but it's only because that video had been maintained in the course of a litigation. Most other requesters are not going to be in that situation. So if the video goes away, they're going to be out of luck. And some of this video, the Metro Transit bus video, squad car video, that falls into the same kind of category that we want to discuss tonight, they provide key insights into government operations. And the uncertainty that flows from the court's opinion could cause problems to accessing this video. So HF 1316 would remedy this issue, and I'm going to speak to the bill's effect as amended by the A18-610 amendment, and I'll mention some of the other amendments as well. So as amended by the A18-610 amendment, the bill would add new language to the list of personnel data in Minnesota Statutes 13.43. And again, there is a specific list of public personnel data within that statute maintained on government employees, maintained on independent contractors, and maintained on volunteers doing work for government entities. And the bill would add one additional item to that public list. That item would ensure that audiovisual recordings documenting activity occurring in a publicly accessible place would be classified as public personnel data. So going back to the example, even if the otherwise public copy of the Metro Transit bus video had been destroyed, the copy maintained in the personnel file as personnel data would still be public under this amendment. And so I want to emphasize that under the amendment to the bill, we're simply trying to keep public what is already public, and thus the bill. To close, I want to discuss how other sections of law interact with this bill as amended in order to put to rest some of the concerns that have been raised in past hearings. In the A18-610 amendment, the amendment language specifically cross-references the existing body camera statute that was added by the legislature in 2016 and notes that body camera video would be treated under that existing provision and section of law. Given the way in which the Data Practices Act works, there are other circumstances in which video data would be governed by other sections of law rather than by the personnel data section and could be kept not public in those specific circumstances. So, for instance, if an armed robbery occurred on a Metro Transit bus and the police opened a case in which the video footage became evidence, then the video would not be personnel data. That would be criminal investigative data and could be maintained as not public until the end of the criminal investigation, as any other piece of criminal investigative data. In another example, if surveillance cameras exist on a St. Paul public school bus and they capture footage of school children, all of that video is already not public under existing law since it is classified as educational data and is private under the existing statute. So the amendment language limits the scope of the bill to activity occurring in a publicly accessible place. And this tailors it to the types of important government data we want to maintain access to, such as squad car video data, the transit data I've spoken of already. And thus, that's why we're bringing the bill forward. Briefly, I'll speak to the other amendments that are out here. The Minnesota Newspaper Association has brought forward other alternative compromise language, that is A18-0611, which is slightly different and more narrow than the A18-0610, in that it incorporates some of the ideas I've talked about where other sections of law would govern this data in certain other circumstances. That is kind of called out as a reference in here. It also defines the location accessible to a general public, a location accessible to the general public. And this is language that came out of the stakeholder meeting that I believe Representative Lesher has already talked about. In reference to the A2 amendment, we would oppose this kind of language. We don't think it's necessary to exempt school districts from the implications of this bill, again, because I'm assuming, and advocates of this language can speak to it themselves, but I'm assuming that if the intent here is to protect private data of school children, that's already protected by current law, and it's not impacted by what we're attempting to do with 1316. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Does anyone have any questions for this testifier? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next testifier is Irene Gao with the League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. Anfinson's not here, is he? Stop saying. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I know it's been a long day, so I'll keep my comments short. Mr. Ealing did a great job of explaining what is happening in data practices in terms of the general presumption of government data as public and personnel data as private. And I was listening to the tape of this hearing from a year ago, and it was good to listen to and remember that while personnel data is complicated, and it is complicated, it was a result of a compromise between unions, government, and those who really hold that government should be transparent and open at heart. So a compromise came to be, and it is complicated. But what we have as public under the personnel data is things that are listed and named specifically. So if you have the presumption where it's private, you're not naming anything that should be private under personnel data specifically. I know this is getting very confusing. And the reason why it matters is because as technology is changing, it's not compensating for the fact that now, instead of something specific by content, an employee's name, what their wages are, we're classifying this based on form, that it's a video. I've worked really hard with other stakeholders to think about, well, how could this impact in the future, unintended consequences? I still have a nagging feeling that there might be something, but I can't quite put my finger on it. And I share all of that to say I'm concerned, but Representative Lesh did work really hard in this stakeholder meeting. I'm going to speak to actually the 611 amendment, because that was the language that Mark Amphinson, and we worked with other stakeholders too. Not everybody was happy, but we did find from the League of Minnesota Cities that this would be workable. I still have the concern about it being broader than the problem that we're trying to fix. But we did work really hard to think about, well, where are the areas where we want to make sure that we maintain privacy for employees or privacy in cities? Areas like a public works garage where the security or the video is for security purposes. We don't want anything stolen. That's not necessarily something that we would fall under the situations that we're talking about with KSTP. So I did want to just say I appreciate the work. We would like to continue to participate in the stakeholder meeting. We'll continue to think about any potential unintended consequences, but I just wanted to get on the record as Representative Lesh had requested.
Thank you, Ms. Gow. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just have a question if you could help clarify.
Sure.
Like any video that's taken at the Capitol is taken in a public place. So would I be able then to make that all public so I could watch who any one of these folks that come and go from? If it's like at the entrance, right, if it's for security purpose or whatever, so I can get video of whoever people are talking with as they come and go from the Capitol, right?
Representative Gow.
Yeah. Thank you for giving me that promotion. Chair.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you. First the legislature would need to be subject to data practices. So let's say that it is. Then, yes, then it would.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the legislature's not, but there are employees. There are government employees that certainly work in the Capitol grounds that are not covered by the legislature. For example, people who work for Capitol Security are not government employees. Other government employees are around here for other reasons. The janitor, for example. So if the data that's recorded, for example, here at the Capitol, is in a public place, I should be able to get access to all of the video, no matter who's in it, if there are public people in it, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is my understanding both under the bill as it currently is as well as the amendments that have been offered, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
I would point out that, Representative Hillstrom, you recall this discussion came up on LPRs as well when we asked if the State Patrol could position a squad at the entrance of the State Office Building ramp and see when legislators came and when they went. So it is particularly poignant and relevant. Question. That's all I wanted to point out.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just believe, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and if you want everybody else's video, I get to get yours.
I have a public land, Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the follow-up piece to that is just the sheer cost of and the time invested in blurring out faces of those that would be protected, leaving clear those that are. Do we have a sense in terms of what this would cost taxpayers to make under this bill? Do we have a sense of that? And I guess that would be to either the testifier or to the author.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The cost of designating video non-public is where those costs get incurred, Representative Carlson. Because if you make a video public, you simply have to release the video, the raw footage, because it's public. But if you want to make it private and apply to blurring out the faces of juveniles or those, you know, have someone decide. That's where you start to get the heavy administrative costs of release of the video. So that's a discussion point that I think will be had when the stakeholders, there are various stakeholders that would like a carve-out, and when, you know, if they receive that, they'll have less of an interest in it. But I hope that we have that discussion in the group.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when we talk about having it public, what's the retention period for this then? How does that apply? And is it standard for everyone? Is it different for different entities? How does, and that to me is where the cost is if you're going to store all this data, that storage cost is huge.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, the Madam Chair and Representative Howe, we haven't gotten into it. That can be a discussion point, but remember that the question relates to the video that's already being collected and stored. Okay, so if video is not collected and stored, there's no question about it. So the agencies from which KSDP or MnCoGi, whomever else wants it, are already retaining and storing the data. We're not asking for any additional cameras to be installed or video to be collected.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how far back can I go? How do they still have it from 10 years ago? If they had the cameras and recording, how far back can I go? And that's...
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Howe, I don't know. It just comes down to, you know, it's these gumshoe sleuths here with the cameras, KSDP, whatever, who get to dig around and say, hey, do you guys have this data? And all of a sudden, they have it. I don't even know about it, but they're trying to get a scoop or something. So I don't know. It really kind of is going to depend on the agency.
Mr. Ealing, I can see you're kind of chomping at the bit to respond to some of these questions. Would you like to come in back to the testifiers table?
If it's helpful for clarifying the retention question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Howe, the retention issue, as Representative Lesh has spoken to, is separate from this, and the retention period for videotape will vary by agency. There's retention periods that are standardized, offered up by the Historical Society, where they tell cities, counties, here's how long you will probably want to retain this material for, but they get to decide, once they're approved by the Records Disposition Panel, to retain it for a specified period of time. So the bill wouldn't adjust the retention period at all. It just adjusts the public classification or the private classification and the access.
And Representative Howe, just so you know, this kind of goes back to my bill on data on the retention periods being consistent, because right now it's a borgeshmorg out there. Right.
Madam Chair,
or Ms. Gao.
Twice with the promotion. Yeah. Madam Chair, members, Representative Howe, this is part of the intersection, as the chair just mentioned, between data practices and records management. Right now, records management, as Mr. Ealing had said, there are different categories, but they are based on the type of record you have. Video doesn't tend to be a type. It is a form in which you have it. So if I have, for example, if you wanted to keep my personnel record could have video, it could have paper, it could have email, it could have a bunch of things, but it needs to be kept for a certain amount of time. So some of it would be dependent probably on what's in that video. But if this bill were to pass, then we would have to come up with a retention period for it. How far can you go back? Well, that depends on what your retention period is. It's probably not retroactive given just how we generally pass bills. I did want to go back, if you don't mind, to Representative Carlson's question. I appreciate what the author was saying. It's a balance, and if everything were public, it would make it easier. Back to when we have personnel data, we want to balance privacy as well. It's important to make sure that we don't be inadvertently release private data, and so it's important for us to review and then redact as we need to.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other member questions? Seeing none. Before you leave, Ms. Gao, so your preference is the
yes.
611 language.
It is, Madam Chair, and I apologize, I didn't talk about 610. My preference would be the 611 language. I appreciate the effort in the 610 language. One of the things that I am concerned about in here is that it only refers to body camera, that being treated as the data classification it is, but as the chair, or as the author had mentioned, there are other areas of law where it would be private. I don't want there to be confusion about which one would trump. So if you have juvenile data, for example, on a video at the same time as it might fall under here, you would still want it to be private. So the section on 1.5 that says are not public under other law is missing from 610, as well as it provides more of a definition in terms of what would be a publicly accessible place. So 611 provides some of that guidance that would be helpful if a bill like this were to pass.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, our next testifier, Mr. Aronson, then Mr. Carlson, then Meg Luger. If you could keep your testimony to a couple minutes, that'd be helpful.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Roger Aronson. I'm counsel for the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. Grace Kelleher is here as well with the School Board Association, and I will keep it short. But the A2 amendment was drafted at our request. One of the things that we're concerned about, and there's a certain part about this that is overly protective, but we're concerned about inroads into school video. We have a tremendous amount of video that we use now in the hallways, not use, that we actually generate in hallways and on school buses. We use these for safety and security of students. It is not as clear as some of the prior testifiers have talked about that just the fact that we would have the label educational data that this would completely protect us. We'd like that to be the case. We think that carving out this particular exception here makes sure that there aren't any inroads into that. So we like this amendment very much. As Ms. Schwab and I were talking about as well, the prior testifier that talks about designation of these places as well, we think is very good. But we wouldn't want to get into a circumstance where the fact that there was the presence one of the adults in a hallway, that suddenly then there's some claim that data becomes public. And that we would have routine requests for information, copies of our video, to show on the news on a daily basis. There's an awful lot of this stuff, and I think one of the things that we always like to come back to, a lot of the public spaces that you're talking about here, people voluntarily decide to go to them, whereas with public school under the Compulsory Attendance Act, we say the kids have to come. They have to be there. And so we think that creates a little different piece as to how this data should be treated. And we appreciate counsel's help in drafting this. But that's our thought here, Madam Chair. That'd answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for this testifier? Representative Lash, were you getting ready to say something? No?
No.
Oh, okay. You look like you had that look on your face that you were. All right. I don't see anyone asking any questions.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I am Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounties Association that consists of 4 suburban counties and 10 greater Minnesota regional counties. Before I respond to questions as to which amendment we prefer, I just want to make clear, repeat what has been said previously, video held in the hands of local governments and state agencies is generally public. Second point I'd want to make is under current law, the specific video that was the subject of this legislation, the bus video on Metro Transit, was ultimately made public and available to KSDP. So you really, frankly, don't have to make a change in the law to accomplish that objective unless you want to reduce the waiting time that they had to go through while the employee discipline proceedings were occurring. That being said, I do want to thank Representative Lesh for holding the stakeholders meeting that he referred to with regards to this bill when it was heard last year. I was a participant in that hearing, and our organization indicated that we did agree with the amendment that came out of that hearing, the A18-611 amendment. As Ms. Gao indicated, we find that preferable to 610 because not only does it make reference to the exception under 13825 the body cam, it also makes references to other laws where the data may not be public. We think this is a reasonable. I will certainly defer to the school districts as to their need to go beyond that. Again, want to thank Representative Lesh for facilitating these stakeholder meetings. And the bottom line is, in instances where there's no reasonable expectation of privacy, we agree that that video should become public, even though it may be the subject of an employee disciplinary proceedings.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for this testifier? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, I'll note this again, that I would ask that all of the stakeholders who are present here tonight, if you could get your name and contact info to my legislative assistant sometime tomorrow, we will be using that list of contacts to contact the people and set a time for a meeting. So thank you.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm not a stakeholder. I've participated in all these meetings. Just a lowly citizen who's had an interest in a lot of these things. I would oppose the A2 amendment. One of the things that we've all learned, and I think policymakers have, is that there's already other law. And to create now an exception or a broad exception, I think raises a number of issues. What are things that should be public or will not be public? And when you already have provisions, two provisions, 1332, which is the FERPA, broad language, educational data, which folks have been using for 35 years, because there's been video, at least for that long, with school requests and all those kinds of things, and lawyers talk to each other a lot, and they'll just say 1332. So it happens. Secondly, is 1337. Mr. Neumeister, you're not going to get the video because we consider it security data. Two provisions in law. So when you add more language, which then will create more uncertainty and misunderstanding or what the heck policymakers and stakeholders and all that are trying to do, just creates more confusion. So that's why I would oppose the A2 amendment. The other item in terms of 610 and 611, they're very complementary to each other. I don't know which is better. I got to think about that. But one thing that came to my mind after, as committee members know, as I shared with you, over the past several months I've been looking at hours and hours of body cam videos, and we're getting in state of video taking. What does this language do that if someone is captured doing something wrong on the video, there is discipline under current law that video would become public because it was used to document a case of discipline? I just want to make sure that in those, a lot of situations where video is public, in those kinds of situations, that having this special thing, 9, which is public, don't over-trump other parts of the personnel division, 1343, and other things, the law that I'm thinking of, but I need a little bit more time to work on what that would be. So that's my 3 cents today.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none. Representative Hilstrom, do you have a question?
No, Madam Chair, I am just envisioning all of the things I can use the video for that we have here at the Capitol. As long as there is a public employee somewhere in the video shot, I can get video of legislators coming and going, and whatever they're doing would be accessible to me. And so, Madam Chair, I'm just over here thinking about all the ways I could get access to that video footage and what uses I might decide to use them for.
Time than me.
Okay.
Deep thoughts.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Hilstrom makes a good point in that as more technologies come online, there become more and more implications to Data Practices Act and carve-outs that are going to, which is why we have a committee on data practices. This is going to get more complicated. year after year. And there will probably be something 5 years from now when everyone's wearing some next generation version of Google Glass or something that makes it accessible thereafter with that too. So I don't even know what's going to happen then. For now, I would just ask, remind folks, if you're a stakeholder and you have an interest in being a part of the stakeholders meeting, please get your information to Madeline Garces, my legislative assistant, by the close of business tomorrow, whereafter we will get that meeting scheduled and reach out to you to see if we can get an agreement on this. So thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair, and I appreciate it.
So I'm really tempted just to go ahead and move this bill and have a vote, but out of deference to you, Representative Lesh, I need a meeting to happen like Monday, and because we're fast approaching deadlines, and between now and Monday anyway, and I want to get this moving, and it's been too long in the making.
Madam Chair, I agree with that. I appreciate it. I know that's your reason for scheduling this for a hearing as well. I would not be seeking this resolution if I didn't expect that us moving forward on this would cause even more problems that we're not aware of. So, but I appreciate the sentiment and agree with you.
Thank you. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we have another body which bills can move in. Is this bill moving in the Senate as well?
Isn't it against the rules to ask about the Senate?
I asked about the bill.
I think he's out of order.
I believe they're planning out. I don't know if they've had the hearing or not.
I think he's out of order.
Okay. I thought that there was. Okay. Okay. The jackets were requested, so I'm assuming that means sooner or later they're going to have another. All right. Thanks, members, for your indulgence. With that, we adjourn.